Wind chill stands at 12 degrees. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I hope that you were able to hear the interview that aired exactly 1 week ago today, on Monday, November 27th, the conversation I was truly privileged to record with best-selling writer and author David Brooks, talking about his most recent book, How to Know a Person, The Art of Seeing Others Deeply and Being Deeply Seen, a book written to address what David Brooks regards as an epidemic of disconnection in our modern world and society. The interview that I am replaying on today's morning show is something of a follow-up to that, an interview that I recorded about a year and a half ago with the co-authors of an intriguing book called Connectable that talks about many of the same issues, but more specifically as they refer to the workplace. Here is that conversation. On today's morning show, we're going to be talking about loneliness and the need that human beings have for connection. And in particular, although we'll talk about loneliness in kind of an overarching way as it affects all of our lives in all kinds of different arenas, we will focus in particular on the way in which loneliness has come to be an increasingly prominent and increasingly serious reality in the workplace. And my guests today on the morning show, Ryan Jenkins and Stephen Van Cohen, have co-authored a book called Connectable: How Leaders Can Move Teams from Isolated to All In. In their really interesting book, they examine, first of all, what loneliness is, how loneliness is different, for instance, from being alone, and how loneliness is becoming worse, some of the causes that are contributing to that, to the rising numbers of people who self-identify as being lonely. And then they move their focus more specifically to the workplace and to some of the things that are going on in our modern-day workplaces that is contributing to this situation, to the situation that they call at one point in the book, a silent, sweeping epidemic of loneliness. Ryan Jenkins is an internationally recognized keynote speaker and an author several times over, and he has made presentations and consulted very important companies like FedEx, Wells Fargo, John Deere. Stephen Cohen is a consultant and executive coach as well, also previously an author with companies like the Home Depot, Bank of America, Bridgestone, the companies that he has worked with on this and other related topics. Once again, this book is titled Connectability: How Leaders Can Move Teams from Isolated to All In. And the book is published by McGraw-Hill. Ryan Jenkins, Stephen Van Cohen, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks for having us.
Pleasure to be here.
I'm glad we can have this conversation. I want to also add something, and I want to get your response to this. In some respects, your book has a very particular focus. That is, I think, the ideal listener or maybe the intended reader of your book is someone who works in the professional world, in the business world, for some kind of company, and is in a position to do something about this epidemic of loneliness in the workplace. But it occurs to me, as someone who does not really qualify as that, that I still found this book really interesting and I think even potentially helpful. And I wonder, as you were writing it, how specifically focused were you on that kind of core intended audience versus writing a book that could also be of interest to others who, for instance, don't work in the typical workplace or are not in the situation that you are primarily talking about?
Yeah, we love to hear that. Thank you, Greg, for sharing that, because we our main focus was to help leaders in the workplace, because it was that's where Steve and I play. That's our arenas. That's where we've helped clients for over a decade now. So we could pull from our expertise and a lot of our networks. And so we wanted to stay there. But as we move through this journey, of course, loneliness is no respecter of person. So we wanted to make this broad enough and accessible to a really wide range of audiences. So I'm glad to hear that. And we've been hearing that from readers and listeners as well, that it is, you know, I don't have to be a leader to benefit from this book, because there's so much in it that we can all take away. And the strategies we give in the book, while really directed towards leaders, they can really be applicable for professionals as well in many contexts. But of course, when reading a book or reading, you know, putting together some type of content, having a more specific audience member in mind is always helpful in guiding that process. So to answer your question, it was where Steve and I most played and had lots of experience. We wanted to not get too far out of our lane, but at the same time, create really valuable resource for anybody that experiences loneliness, which, spoiler alert, is all of us.
It sure is. Absolutely. Stephen Van Cohen, how did the two of you know each other? How did you first connect?
Well, I had an idea for a company back in 2017 to create some very specific training programs for emerging professionals. I do a lot of consulting and coaching, and I kept getting asked by my clients to help them understand the emerging generation. So I was looking for partners to help in this new business endeavor, and I was doing research on millennials in the workplace, and every article I found was written by this really brilliant guy named Ryan Jenkins. And I said to myself, I have to reach out to this individual. I have to forge a connection. And I sent him a few emails, of which he decided not to respond to early on. And then luckily, his better half, his wife, Ashley, one day said, you know what, you should really email this guy back. And that was 5 years ago. And it's taken us on this whirlwind of a journey with regards to our businesses and the ability to write this book together. And we forged this amazing friendship and business relationship. So all of that came from a wild, wacky idea I had and looking for people to help me bring it to life.
Cool. How did you write this book together? What are the nuts and bolts of your process by which you co-wrote Connectability?
I will say that it was an extremely it was a gift to be able to write with Ryan. And Ryan and I have very different strengths. So the book is a culmination of both of our strengths being married together as we wrote together. And my strength is the ability to have big ideas. I kind of float around in the ether with a lot of really, you know, abstract thoughts. And I pulled a lot of the stories. I did all the interviews with the people that we, you know, talked to in the book. I was the one who created all of the client examples. And I essentially gave Ryan hundreds of pages of just stuff. And I said, I think there's probably something within all of these words and all of these pages. And then Ryan was the mastermind who built these beautiful connections and created the narrative and pulled it all together. So, you know, it was wonderful having him be a part of this collaboration.
So it's Ryan who made this a 300-page book rather than a 3,000-page book.
Exactly. Yep.
The other interesting tidbit here, Greg, is that I'm an introvert, Steve's an extrovert. And so, you know, when we're talking about the topic of loneliness and connection, we give very interesting perspectives from the topic in the book as well. And that's a question we get all the time is, well, what's the difference? How do both extroverts and introverts process loneliness? And so we give interesting perspectives on that. And again, it lands with a much wider spectrum of readers that way.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Ryan Jenkins and Stephen Van Cohen, co-authors of a book called Connectable: How Leaders Can Move Teams from Isolated to All In. This is a book about loneliness and about being better connected. And although its primary focus is on loneliness in the workplace, it by no means is limited to that arena. And a lot of different people, I think, can find a lot of interesting things to pull from this interesting book. One thing I am really anxious to ask you and I'm very curious to get your perspective, is at the heart and soul of your book is this thing that, again, you call at one point a silent sweeping epidemic, with more and more people seemingly day by day describing themselves as often lonely, and particularly lonely in the workplace. And one takes away from that the sense that people have never been as lonely as they are now. It just occurs to me, though, that when we look a little farther back in human history, there probably has been a lot of loneliness that we can't begin to even imagine. I'm thinking of, you know, Little House on the Prairie. And I mean, I don't mean the way it is depicted through the soft focus of TV, but when you just think about the harsh isolation that people would experience in far-flung places, do you think very much about how loneliness has played out in the past? I know it's not the focus of your book, but I'm just really curious to get your sense of how much loneliness has actually always been with us. And are we talking about a different kind of loneliness now that maybe is perhaps more harmful?
Yeah, the I'm reading a great book right now by Joe Keohan, and it's called The Power of Strangers. And he actually addresses your question to a T. And he talks about how, yeah, when we were when we used to farm and, you know, doing agriculture, we would just see the faces of our family, and that's the only people we knew. And we would be very cautious and suspicious of strangers. So there was a certain different dynamic to connection there. But then he also talks about how, you know, 6,000 years ago, we started creating cities. And there's really strong research to indicate that velocity is actually detrimental to connection. So the faster that things are moving in a city, and the faster pacing that people have in the city, they're much less likely to actually engage with others. And so it's interesting, we created these cities to kind of, you know, create more connection and to pull resources and to collaborate. But as things have moved on, you know, things are just getting busier and busier and busier. And according to the research that Steve and I unpacked and put in the book, it mirrors this as well, that is, the faster that things are moving, the busier we are, the less likely we are to interact with one another. So the research, the history of loneliness in humans is really fascinating. And to sum it up, yes, it's been increasing in the last several decades. And the pandemic, of course, put a spotlight on it. It accelerated during the pandemic. And that's why we're excited to broach this topic. And of course, it's increasing, but guess what? That means it's malleable. So it can also decrease. And so that's our big focus, is to help folks, give folks some tools and some resources to be able to reduce loneliness and isolation so that we can re-engage with humanity.
There are some really interesting components, though, to understand why we are feeling lonelier today than we did, let's just say, 30 years ago. And to begin, we need to define loneliness, because loneliness is the absence of connection, not people. It's the absence of connection, not people. You could be surrounded by people and still feel debilitatingly lonely. It's the connection between those that allows for us to feel a certain way.
I was just going to say, I think, if anything, we feel the loneliest kind of loneliness. I mean, the worst, most painful kind of loneliness, when we are surrounded by people with whom we feel no connection. I mean, I think that's a whole different kind of loneliness versus the wife in the house on the prairie while her husband is plowing the field with neighbors who are 5 miles away. That's one kind of loneliness that maybe looks more stark at a glance, but probably is not as painful as when one is surrounded by people with whom you feel no connection and you are feeling this loneliness that you assume nobody else there is feeling.
Well, we say in the book, loneliness is essentially being seen through. And we say belonging is the ability to be seen as, right? It's when you are with someone and they fully are in tune with you. They're empathizing with you. They care about you. And when we pick up on those receptions from other people, well, we start to feel less lonely. But when we're with other people, and, you know, Ryan mentioned busyness, a lot of the interactions we have today are transactional. And a lot of the communication that we have today is through email and IM and instant message. And those are all, you know, communication strategies they're not necessarily connection points. The part of the brain that registers communication is a different part of the brain that registers connection. So we're communicating more than we ever have before in history. And we have access to more people than we ever have in history. And yet we're feeling a certain way because the connection isn't there.
Mm. So probably you're highlighting a connection between terms that we shouldn't make carelessly. That is, I think a lot of us think about communicating with someone as being the same as connecting with someone. And you're suggesting that there are really big differences. What would you say that distinction is? What does it take for communication with someone to become connection with someone?
Yeah, I think it's sharing something personal, right? Or finding uncommon commonalities, right? It's one thing to both like NFL football, but if we're both Denver Bronco fans, well, that brings a new kind of intensity to that connection. So sharing something personal, trying to get there. Another big thing is just presence, right? We feel this. And the comment you made earlier, Greg, about, you know, we can feel the loneliest when we're around people. It reminded me of a quote by the late Robin Williams, actor and comedian. He said, "I used to think the worst thing in life was to end up all alone. It's not. The worst thing in life is to end up with people who make you feel all alone." And so I think that's a powerful reminder to all of us that, you know, we need to make it a priority to never make someone feel alone, especially when you're with them. And we all can feel this, right? We've been on the receiving end of this when someone is eyeball to eyeball you with you and you know that you've got their full presence and attention. That is a gift. And you don't have to look much further than Facebook or Instagram or TikTok and how valuable those companies are. Why? Because they're mining human attention. Our attention is so extremely valuable. And if we can learn to direct that more intentionally and with focus on people, oh my gosh, we're going to see this loneliness epidemic move in a different direction. And so I think that's really important. Presence is a big thing. And then sharing something personal and finding those uncommon commonalities can be really important.
Right. And I want to reiterate that I think your book gets me thinking about all kinds of things, even though I don't really work in a particularly typical workplace. And so your book was not aimed at me as such. And yet I found lots to think about and lots to take away that is applicable to all kinds of other places. I'm thinking about like my church and when a visitor comes who doesn't know anybody. And if it's a church that's full of shy people who are hesitant about making a newcomer feel welcome, I mean, that's just about the loneliest feeling you could possibly have. And it hurts versus being a newcomer and being welcomed by somebody who's brave enough to extend their hand and make a connection and so on. I mean, this applies to that arena and to lots of other arenas in our day-to-day lives.
Well, the research shows that it only takes 40 seconds to have what's called a restorative connection. So when two people can make eye contact, smile at one another, have a genuine, hey, how's your day going? When both people are able to see one another, 40 seconds is all it takes. So it's not this, we got to, you know, cut out half of our to-do list and we got to start spending all this quality time with people. You can, by using what are called pro-social behaviors, find ways to build really quick, meaningful connections. And one of the best lines that we put in the book, and it's one of Ryan's lines as an introvert, he learned that you don't necessarily need to make sure that every connection is sustainable. Like connections don't have to be lasting to be meaningful. All of those little tiny interactions that you have the ability to essentially make you feel seen and you know, feel a part of humanity and to feel welcomed and people have interest in you. So don't forget, right? Those little moments, relationships don't have to be lasting to be meaningful.
Right. And the investment can be relatively modest in terms of our own time. Yeah, very well said. When you talk about what is driving this silent, sweeping epidemic of loneliness, one of the things you talk about is technology and the way in which technology has made our day-to-day lives and so many of our transactions and interactions so much smoother, so much more convenient. And yet there is, I think you say at one point, a catch in the convenience. I mean, that there's a what otherwise we might think of as an entirely positive thing isn't necessarily positive in every respect. Explain how the rise of technology, beyond the obvious, I mean, beyond the fact that we're staring at our cell phones, I think we all are aware of that, but your book really points out some other ways, less obvious, in which technology is making all of us feel a little less connected with each other.
So Ryan, how about I share one and then you share one?
Sure.
The biggest eye-opener for me, Greg, as we were doing this research, and you're right, technology, that's a big overarching problem. But one of the micro components to this technological problem is what we call dependency shift. So 20 years ago, if I was going to take a date out, I would call a friend to figure out which restaurant to go to. If something broke in my house, I might go to a neighbor for help. And if I needed advice, I would call my mom. Today, if I need to figure out where to take a date, I go to Yelp. If something breaks in my house, I go to YouTube. If I need advice, I go to Google. We just aren't needing each other as much as we once did, right? So while technology has allowed things to be convenient, because I can just quickly go online and get what I need and be done, it has stripped us from lots of opportunities to be helpful to one another. And that's a big problem with why we just aren't spending as much time having those meaningful interactions that we used to.
I got to say, I can think of several unpleasant moments on Facebook where in a discussion group that I'm part of, maybe about, you know, one of my favorite TV shows or opera or whatever, that one of my favorite things is to pose a question about, you know, such and such a singer or such and such an actor on Star Trek or whatever it might be. And sometimes there will be somebody who pops up and says, you don't have to ask us that. I mean, go to Wikipedia or whatever. I mean, but you know, their answer to that is go find the answer yourself. I mean, that's nothing we have to answer for you. And of course, that's not the point of posing a question like that. It's often just the enjoyment of hearing how different people answer a basic question. But you're pointing to something that for more and more of us, that doesn't even occur to us to look for information that way from each other when we have this thing called Google or Wikipedia or whatever that gives us those answers almost too readily.
Another good example of what we're talking about here and a good analogy here is the ATM, the automated teller machine. The inventor of that is Donald Wetzel, and we chronicle his story in one of our chapters. But he had the idea of the ATM while standing in line at a bank, and he was standing in line for over 20 minutes. I mean, he could have watched a whole episode of The Office while standing in line. And he thought, well, how can we automate this process? And sure enough, they create the ATM. And so people then began to gravitate towards the ATM. And of course, they should, right? That's convenient. It's easier. But when we tend to go towards the convenience, there's typically a cost, and typically that cost is social. And so in this instance, right, we chose the ATM. Well, now the social cost is we don't have time to interact with the folks in the line. We're not interacting with the bank tellers or bank employees. And ATMs are coming in all shapes and sizes these days, right? Whether it's mobile banking or meal delivery or texting, there's all these conveniences in our life that we are now choosing. And oftentimes we're leaving connection hanging in the wind. And technology is not bad. If I ask the listeners right now, if I was to hand you a button that said delete the internet or delete all technology, that if you pressed it, it would delete all these magnificent things, would you press it? Most people wouldn't. According to my research, nearly zero people would actually push that because the benefits slightly outweigh the risks. So this isn't a conversation hating technology because it's useful. I don't want to go back and have to unfold a roadmap to figure out where I'm going. I want to use GPS on my phone. But we just have to be much more vigilant. And the case we make in our book is that belonging and human connection is one of the most dire needs we have as humanity. So while we continue to choose convenience and use these technology tools to enrich our lives, we have to use the time that we save in those instances to prioritize more human connection. So it's this balance that we've got to strike, and it's so important. And as technology continues to come at us faster and faster, this is a more and more important conversation, and we all got to keep each other accountable here.
At one point in your book, you say, we are subtly turning our back on humanity every day. You say that in the context of talking, I think, about the ATM and other technologies that in a sense, strip away some of those person-to-person interactions that once upon a time we had to have to get money out of the bank or whatever. I also want to ask you about something else in this chapter where you talk about the virality of loneliness. Let me just make sure our listeners understand that word, V-I-R-A-L-I-T-Y, the virality or virality of loneliness, where loneliness spreads like a virus. Briefly, what are you talking about there? In what way can loneliness spread like a virus?
Loneliness is an emotion, right? Just like when someone's feeling sad and you're in their presence, sometimes you feel sad. Or when someone comes with a big beaming smile, you smile. In our brains, we have what are called mirroring neurons, and it's allowed us to get in sync with the people around us. And it was a survival mechanism many, many, many millenniums ago, because we knew to be able to get in sync with a tribe or with other people, our survival was boosted exponentially. So when someone's feeling lonely, they're giving off different emotional cues, and those emotional cues are felt by other people. And it could spread just like a virus. And we say in our book, and it's been proven through the research, that you're only as connected as the loneliest member of your team. And when someone on your team is feeling chronically lonely or showing up and displaying real telltale signs of loneliness, that is impacting everybody on the team in some form or fashion, oftentimes without awareness or acknowledgement. So when we say this is an important topic we have to fix, it's potentially going to continue to get worse as more and more people feel this sensation.
Yeah, the other aspect here too, Greg, is what tends to happen when you experience loneliness is you turn inward, the exact opposite of what you should do, which would be turn outward. And so if you're in a community and you're experiencing loneliness, well, you're going to tend to turn inward, and then you're start avoiding others, and you're going to start distrusting others. So you make yourself less approachable. Well, then that leaves less people within that community to actually create connections. And so if that happens multiple times, all of a sudden that community can really fracture and kind of fall apart. So that contributes to this virality as well.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Ryan Jenkins and Stephen Van Cohen about their book, Connectable, How Leaders Can Move Teams from Isolated to All In. The book is a really fascinating, thoughtfully written examination of what loneliness is and the factors in modern life that are contributing to escalating numbers of people feeling lonely at given points in their lives, and some people feeling kind of a perpetual loneliness. And in particular, they focus on how this tends to play out in the workplace. I want to be sure that I give you a chance to talk about some different stripes of loneliness that one sees, I think, particularly in the workplace, although maybe in other areas of life, these distinctions are present as well. But I'm talking about a place in the book when you talk about situational versus differential versus intentional kinds of loneliness. Can you explain those distinctions and why you think they're important for us to know?
Yeah, loneliness is a complex human emotion, which we are complex beings. But yeah, there's really kind of three flavors. And the first of which is situational, which a good example there is if you move to a new town or city, right? It's a situation that's occurred and you don't have the connections that you once did. So there's a situation that is lending itself to having you feel lonely. Another might be differential, which means you may not have the same skill sets, perhaps, as other folks around you. I share in the book, I had this experience. I went to Miami University, and that when I was in orientation, becoming a freshman, everyone was asked to sign up for their courses, and they all of a sudden just jumped on their email and started whizzing away on their laptop. Well, it wasn't laptops, it was just desktops at the time. And I had no idea what to do because I hadn't been using email. I spent too much time in the hockey rink in Denver, Colorado, and I didn't know where my email was and how to use it. And I felt extremely isolated and alone in that moment because everyone else around me had a different skill set than I did. And then the last example is really around intentional. So that's maybe when you intentionally try to isolate someone to belittle them or to, you know, use as a power move. So these are all subtle dynamics on which we can experience isolation and loneliness.
And Greg, real quick, I'll like to preface by saying in our research, 72% of the people out of the 2,000 that we surveyed feel lonely on a monthly basis, and 55% feel lonely on a weekly basis. And as we've done client events, that demographic, depending on the client and the workload, can reach over 80% of people feeling regularly lonely. So when we talk about situational loneliness, there are so many life situations that happen. It's lonely when you're lost. So anytime you're doing something and you don't have a clear direction, you feel lonely. Changing teams, you know, going through a divorce or a breakup, going through a loss of a loved one. There are so many scenarios, which is why the vast majority of us have felt lonely at some point in time in our lives. And it's important for us to understand that this isn't some shameful black eye. It's a birthmark. We all have this birthmark. It just comes in different shapes and different sizes for different people at different times.
It's so interesting, the terms that we have to be careful about, because as you're saying that, I'm tempted to ask, but isn't it okay to sometimes be lonely? Isn't it a normal thing? But then I'm realizing I'm kind of blurring the term lonely with alone. And of course, your book goes out of its way to say at one point that that aloneness can be a really positive thing, that it can even lessen loneliness. It's one of the strategies you share later in the book. But that's different. I mean, being alone is different from being lonely. Would you say that lonely, being lonely, is ever a positive thing? Or at least generally speaking, is that something that we should, in a sense, avoid at all costs?
Well, it's positive in the sense that it means your brain works. Just like when you feel hungry, it's your biological cue to go eat something. When you feel lonely, that's simply your brain saying, hey, it's time to go forge a connection. Right? Like, it is a useful emotion, just like all of the emotions we have, so have a purpose. Loneliness serves its purpose. So in that sense, it's a wonderful reminder that we need each other. And when we feel a certain way, it's just a cue to go seek out some new connections. Right?
That's right. I think at one point in the book, you say loneliness is our brain telling us that it's time to seek your tribe or something like that, right?
Yeah. Yeah, another good way to think about this is, you know, isolation is really, it's not positive or negative. The negative state of isolation is loneliness, but as Steve just mentioned, it's still useful. That's why we have that. It's nature's nudge to let us know that we belong together and we should forge connections when we experience that. But the positive state of isolation, to your point, Greg, is solitude, right? I mean, we can be alone and really experience tremendous benefits. So again, think back to the definition of loneliness. It's not the absence of people, it's the absence of connection. So, and when you're in solitude and you're having, how we define solitude is when your thoughts are self-directed, right? You're free from the minds of others and you're able to, so you could experience solitude in a crowded coffee shop if your thoughts are self-directed, and you can strengthen your connection with yourself. So that's the key there, right? If you're cultivating a strong connection with yourself, and you can do that with solitude. And yeah, we think that solitude is insurance against loneliness. So absolutely, aloneness can lessen loneliness if we're intentional about it. And solitude can come in the form of meditation or journaling or just being with your thoughts. So it's really a key contributor. And we wanted to highlight it specifically for leaders because we know leaders are going ahead and they're typically finding isolation. They're ahead of the pack alone, trying to capture a preferred future and draw it closer to folks. So absolutely, solitude can be helpful in this regard when it comes to lessening loneliness.
Stephen Van Cohen, you just mentioned something in passing that I want to make sure we significantly acknowledge, and that is the fact that loneliness tends to come with a stigma. That is, when we feel lonely, we tend to feel embarrassed or ashamed. I suppose in many cases, when we feel lonely, that's tied up to a sense of that we are not worthy of friendship or connection, that there's something wrong with us. And that's why people are pulling away from us or not seeing us or ignoring us. And that's probably also a complicating factor when it comes to dealing with loneliness, when it's something that people are embarrassed to acknowledge.
And it's why instead of reaching outward, we turn inward, like Ryan mentioned earlier. The best way that I've thought about describing the feeling of loneliness when you feel it is essentially this idea that you're an unlovable loser. And that's a really awful feeling to have. And while I mentioned earlier that it is a biological reminder to go seek a connection, the way that it's been stigmatized and the way that we internalize that sensation has been shrouded in shame. And part of the goal with the book is to essentially destigmatize what is a core human emotion. And in the book, we use some illustrations and we find really unique ways to talk about this very sensitive, highly charged topic in a way that makes it really acceptable. And hopefully, if anybody is out there who's feeling lonely, if they read the book or if they start to do a bit more research on the topic, they'll understand that this is totally normal and they're not an unlovable loser. It's just that they need to find ways to be more connected. And when we talk about connection, and it's something we haven't addressed yet, connection comes in all kinds of forms and fashions. Ryan mentioned you can connect with yourself, connection with team members, connection with a leader, connection with the community, connection with loved ones, connection with your work, connection with purpose. So there are lots and lots of connection points. So when someone feels lonely and they might want to retreat inward, if they know that they can seek connections in all kinds of different ways, it could hopefully encourage them to take some steps in order to not feel this way anymore.
And it just occurs to me that I think when we're talking about an employee in a fairly ordinary workplace, it would be probably especially hard to talk about something as deeply personal as loneliness in that environment. I mean, it's another thing when you are with your book club, your good friends, or at a family reunion, or at your church, or wherever. But in the workplace, where we want to have project a sense of having it all together, of being capable to admit this kind of vulnerability, I should think is really difficult, which really underscores the importance of writing a book that really has the workplace primarily in mind.
Yeah, we there's a section in the book where we talk about Movember, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with, where folks grow a mustache in to raise awareness around cancer. And it's this idea that no one, you know, they don't have to actually talk about cancer, just grow the mustache and it kind of inadvertently draws attention to curing cancer. And similarly, we can address loneliness without ever talking about it. We, you know, Steve and I would encourage you to start talk about it more, because in our experience, as soon as you talk about it, everyone leans in, because we haven't been talking about it and everyone has a story and can relate to it. So everyone leans in. But to your point, Greg, sometimes it feels too much in the workplace, but there's all kinds of different things that we can still do to address it without ever talking about it, right? We can talk about creating deeper connection, more belonging, creating more inclusive work environments. These are all terms that are much more readily accessible at work that we can cling on to. But we like to tell folks, just assume that members in your community and members on your team are lonely, because according to our research of over 2,000 global workers, it's not a matter of if your team is lonely, it's a matter of how many. And so taking these steps to create more connection and a stronger sense of belonging is really important. And you don't have to talk about and use the term loneliness. We'd encourage you to, but you don't have to.
Right. I really appreciated a point in the book when you talk about, and then this is a case where your book is really focused on a leader in a workplace, in terms of, although I suppose for coworkers, this is important too, how do you spot somebody who is lonely, who is feeling lonely and is maybe not said anything out loud? I mean, in a sense, confessing it, you know, it's not a sin to confess, but I mean, professing that they are admitting that they're lonely. You give some suggestions on how this can be spotted, because of course we're talking about something that's not like somebody walking in with an arm in a sling or a big bandage on their nose. I mean, this is in a sense an invisible pain, an invisible injury that someone is experiencing.
It is a bit elusive. However, when you know what to look for, you can start to spot it. There's a great quote by the famed photographer Ansel Adams, and Ansel says, "Photos are usually looked at, seldom looked into." Wow. When we think about the way in which we now work, if we care about the people around us, we need to start looking into them. We see people all the time, but are we really paying attention to some of the off behavioral characteristics that they're displaying that maybe give us a signal that something might be off? And in the book, we have 10 telltale signs. And on our website, leslinley.com, there's a check sheet that people can go through to start to identify if people, you know, on their teams or in their communities might be feeling this way. And, you know, the two that I think are most interesting is a lack of learning and development, meaning that when someone is not continuously striving to be better, they're not trying to learn new things, they're kind of just remaining status quo and they're just going along for the ride, that's a sign that they aren't feeling as confident or as inspired. And then the other one for me is excessive work. If people are working all the time, it might be because they're masking some of the, you know, feelings they have in their personal life that they don't want to tend to. So they just work and work and work and work and work. And while excessive work might seem like a good thing for a leader in an organization, excessive work eventually leads to some really dire outcomes. So pinpointing that, hey, you know what? Greg is working way more than usual. Maybe it's because there's something going on that he's wanting to distract himself from in his personal life.
Right. Or wanting to maintain that sense of distance, because in a sense that might be, in the moment, might feel a lot less painful than
totally. Yep.
Yeah. We certainly don't have time to thoroughly examine all of the different suggestions that are in your book about how some of this can be addressed, but I certainly want to give you an opportunity to talk about at least a couple of the basic ideas you have. But I want to zero in for a moment on a specific that I found really, really intriguing amongst a number of different situations, or I should say suggestions. One of them you said is, don't rely on outings and activities. That is, it might be really tempting if one thinks like, oh yeah, we need a lot more connection in our workplace. Okay, so let's all go hiking or let's all go whatever. You don't want that to be given too much emphasis. Maybe that's a bit of a crutch, or what is the problem with thinking in those terms, and in what other terms would you prefer that people think?
Yeah, we have some very humorous visuals that we portray in the book that really lean in and put some pressure on happy hours. And you know what tends to happen when we gather with people in an organization from our team, what tends to happen is we tend to talk about what we have most in common, which ends up being work. And we tend to hang out with people that have the similar backgrounds. So the sales teams will stick together, the IT folks will stick together, and there's not a lot of interaction of new connections that occur. So, you know, those environments can work, but too often folks, just so many of the organizations that we work with, just do it as a kind of a band-aid and let's just do it. And that'll help people feel more connected. You got to be more intentional. So you got to create environments where uncommon connections are happening, right? People that normally wouldn't get together can connect, or you're talking about non-work related things where, again, people can find those uncommon commonalities. One of my favorite strategies is helping people to connect to their purpose at work, a deeper meaning behind their work. And one of the ways to do that is to identify the beneficiaries of the work. Research tells us that radiologists can interpret x-rays more accurately if they see a picture of the patient. Cooks perform better if they actually can see the people that will be eating their food. So if we can create a stronger connection between the work that we do and the people that are actually benefiting from that work, we see more meaning at work, but also loneliness is lessened because there's a strong connection between what we do and the people that are benefiting. And you might not have to meet those people, but just having an idea of the work that you're doing. And so a leader can help the teams, you know, find that to identify the beneficiaries of the work, but individuals themselves can practice on their own to figure out who is actually benefiting from the work that I'm doing. So those are a couple of things that to keep in mind.
And there's 150 pages of strategies in the book. So, you know, there's a whole lot to dive into. My favorite, one of the sections is what we call invest in connections. And it's all about how do you find ways to build meaningful relationships at work in strategic ways. And there's a practice that I use all the time that works wonderfully called listening to unlock. And when we listen to others, we usually listen to win or listen to fix. We listen to win to help you know, essentially get our point across or help give somebody direction, or we listen to fix, or we're just figuring out what kind of advice we can give. But when we listen to unlock, it's when we listen with a genuine sense of curiosity. I just want to understand your point, and I'm curious about what you're thinking and feeling and going through. And for any of us, regardless of how high up the totem pole we are in our organization, that's a universal human skill set, that when we can listen to unlock, it triggers the other person and they can immediately feel like, hey, this individual is really listening to me, and it creates that sense of being seen. So that's one of the many strategies that I use regularly that works quite well.
I want to also mention that your book examines at some length the whole notion of safety in the workplace. I mean, in the sense of people feeling emotionally safe, creating in that way kind of a safe environment in which some of these connections can be better forged. And I really appreciated that portion of the book. But here's the last question. At one point in the book, you say, loneliness is not a problem to solve. It's a tension to manage. So what's behind those intriguing words? And we just have a couple minutes, I'm afraid.
Yeah, I mean, you know, hopefully the listeners have grasped the idea that loneliness, you know, it's going to be with us. It's a useful thing. Well, it's maybe not desirable. It's useful because it's our biological cue that we belong together. So it's not going away. And we don't just connect with someone once and then our well-being bucket is filled forever. We have to constantly connect and constantly nurture our connections to keep our well-being boosted. And so that's why it's always going to be a tension to manage. We just can't, it's not a problem that we solve once. We're always going to have to tend and be aware of our loneliness levels and come up with new strategies and keep our tech in check and do all these things that we talked about in this wonderful conversation to make sure that we continue to keep loneliness at bay and bolster our connections.
Well, I found so much to take away from your book that I really thoroughly enjoyed, and it just gave me so much to think about. And again, I'm not really your target in terms of the audience that you intended primarily for your book, but I found so much to be useful here, and I think a whole lot of people would. But also, of course, particularly for people who are in a position of leadership in a workplace, and even coworkers who can just be better coworkers with one another if they feel like there are means by which they can have better connection with those around them. There's lots to take away from your book called Connectable, How Leaders Can Move Teams from Isolated to All In, published by McGraw-Hill, the co-authors Ryan Jenkins and Stephen Van Cohen. I thank both of you for joining me today on The Morning Show. I really enjoyed both your book and this conversation. Best wishes to you.
Thank you, Greg.
Thank you, Greg.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I'm excited to welcome back into our studios Dr. Art Sear to pay his monthly visit to the program. He'll offer up his analysis on current events and issues. Wednesday's program will include a preview of the Racine Theatre Guild's current production, which is of The Little Mermaid. I'll be joined by Doug Instanis, Managing and Artistic Director of the Racine Theatre Guild. On Thursday, we'll have actually a crowded array of guests, including Maestro Bob Hasty from the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra. And we'll be talking about their very festive concert that's coming up this weekend, which will include, among other things, a guest performance by the Lincoln Chamber Singers at Carthage College. Their director, Dr. Maggie Burke, will be among the guests that we'll have with us for Thursday's morning show.
And on Friday, we're going to be previewing several different events coming up this weekend, including, we hope, a conversation about the Lakeside Players' current production, which opened this past weekend, of A Charlie Brown Christmas. And we hope to talk about a couple of special holiday concerts that are also coming up this weekend. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, wgtd.org. And we remind you that by subscribing to the Morning Show podcast, you can enjoy a different morning show 7 days a week, including treasures from the archives.